Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. We have today with us someone well-known to First Things readers, Frances Beckwith, who is professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University, a prolific author, many books and articles, too many to enumerate, all it seems, but including Taking Rights Seriously, Law, Politics, and the Reasonableness of Faith. And by the way, that's rights, R-I-T-E-S, which was just a couple of years from Cambridge Press. He has a new book out, a book about Thomas Aquinas called Never Doubt Thomas, the Catholic Aquinas as Evangelical and Protestant. Frank, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You've been Catholic and Protestant, we find in the first few pages of the book. And maybe that'll help us explain the subtitle here, The Catholic Aquinas as Evangelical and Protestant.
Yeah, I grew up Catholic. I actually grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, which is an unusual place to grow up, I suppose. I suspect nobody really grows up in Vegas, right? You just get older. And so my parents moved there in 1967. I was 6 years old, so I had to go with them. And I went to Catholic elementary and high school. And then when I was a youngster, I began sort of drifting away from the Catholic faith and was very much impressed by my evangelical friends. I was born in 1960, so I came of age during that era, soon after the Second Vatican Council. And a lot of the parishes in our community had, I think, drifted away from more traditional catechesis. And so my evangelical friends seemed to be sort of interested in these theological questions that as a 11 or 12 year old, I was interested in. And it was around that time that I actually became aware of St. Thomas Aquinas. My parents, seeing that I was moving away from the church, suggested that I attend a 4-day retreat at the parish that was put on by some Dominicans from the Bay Area. And I remember going up to the front after each session and arguing with one of these Dominican priests.
Harry, here comes that kid again.
Yeah, and it was, you know, he recommended that I read Aquinas, and I didn't. I just went on my merry way and then eventually drifted away from the church. But then when I was in college, I came across certain evangelical authors that actually had a very positive account of Aquinas, one of whom was Norman Geisler, the founder of Southern Evangelical Seminary, who had done his PhD at Loyola of Chicago. And certain other evangelical thinkers that, even though they may not call themselves Thomists, they were very respectful of Aquinas and thought that some of his arguments concerning the existence of God and the existence of the soul were persuasive. And I didn't really realize it until years later that these figures that I had encountered in the evangelical world were actually quite unusual in the evangelical world. There were probably far more theologians that didn't like Aquinas than liked him. But I was drawn to Thomas. I actually went to graduate school. I chose the graduate school that I eventually selected based on the fact that there were professors there that were experts in Aquinas. I did my PhD at Fordham University in New York City, and I studied with Father Norris Clark and Father Gerald McCool and several others that were scholars of Aquinas. So I considered myself, by the time I left the doctoral program at Fordham, as a kind of evangelical Thomist. And
now did your teachers, so your teachers there at Fordham, they wouldn't have found that an impossible formulation at all?
No, not at all. In fact, I remember doing wrote a term paper for Father Clark's Aquinas class on Aquinas's cosmological argument and or the five ways, three of which are considered kind of cosmological type arguments. And I quoted in my paper several of these evangelical writers, including Norman Geisler, and Father Clark was really fascinated by this. And I lent him my copy of Geisler's Philosophy of Religion. And he was really, you know, kind of taken aback by this. He did not know that there were such figures. But you're right, though, in terms of the way in which those of us that were drawn to Aquinas from the evangelical world looked at him, we looked at him as a kind of ally in response to challenges to the Christian faith. So his arguments for God's existence, his arguments for the existence of the soul, we largely ignored his writings that dealt with issues concerning ecclesiology and the sacraments. So in my mind, there was this kind of Catholic Aquinas that I didn't really want to deal with. And then there was the Aquinas, the philosopher, who was really helpful in terms of defending my faith or better understanding it. As I got older, though, I began to realize that you really couldn't separate Aquinas the philosopher from Aquinas the Dominican priest. They were the same person, and that his views were fully integrated.
So from there, you became an Aquinas scholar. You've been that ever since.
I don't consider myself an Aquinas scholar. I consider myself a Thomist. Most of my work has been in mostly political and social philosophy and a little bit in philosophy of religion. I love Aquinas. I consider myself a follower of his, but I don't consider myself an Aquinas scholar in the sense that I've spent, you know, a vast majority of my time studying him and writing on him. In fact, when I was working on this book, I was kind of nervous. You know, will my book be received by sort of the Aquinas
establishment?
Yeah.
Well, let me say, I mean, in the book, let me say to our listeners that it really is. Tell me if you this characterization is right. It really is taking an Aquinas perspective on contemporary issues of controversy.
That's right. And I picked four issues that were actually personally important to me. They were issues that I had to work through in my own journey back to the Catholic Church and then even afterwards. So one question that always had interested me was the relationship between natural law and natural theology and what we believe based on faith. And so one of the chapters, I work through some of the criticisms that have been leveled against the natural law, as well as the role that natural theology plays in one's faith commitment. And so that's one of the issues. And then another one was having to do with the doctrine of justification. About 12 years ago, or 13 years ago now, thinking about returning to the church as I did in my mid-40s, as I began working through some of these questions that were difficult, one of them was the doctrine of justification. And I read several evangelical authors that would say things like this, evangelical authors that liked Aquinas, they would say that Thomas's view on the doctrine of justification is different from the one held by the Council of Trent or the contemporary catechism. And as I began reading Aquinas, I actually came to the different conclusion that, in fact, Aquinas's view is of a piece with not only his successors in the Council of Trent and in the magisterium of the church today, his views are consistent with his predecessors, Augustine and the Council of Orange and other writers. And so I began seeing Aquinas as somebody that could be appropriated by evangelicals in a way that actually shows maybe a greater unity or maybe we're a little bit closer than we think, evangelicals and Catholics. If these writers can read Aquinas in this way, and one theory I have is why they read him in that way is they love him. and they don't want him to be wrong. And secondly, Aquinas is not writing polemically in response to the Protestant reformers. He's writing to a church that is largely unified. And so there's not that kind of underlying hostility.
You know, let me just mention the chapter headings after the introduction, Why Thomas Today. We have, it's very clear. An exposition. Aquinas is Protestant, Aquinas is pluralist, Aquinas is theologian, Aquinas is evangelical. And then we have the Aquinas option. That's not the Benedict option. The Aquinas option in the last one.
By the way, I actually think that Rod Dreher should write a cookbook for breakfast called The Eggs Benedict Option. I don't know if that's a good joke or not.
I'll take it. But, you know, when I was reading in through here, Aquinas as Protestant, I have to read your opening sentence in the chapter and just give a little bit of reflection on my background. The first sentence is, if St. Thomas Aquinas is known for anything, it is his belief that human beings have the capacity to know by their natural reason, apart from the deliverances of scripture or ecclesial authority, that God exists and that there is a natural moral law. Now, just I came through the humanities. This was in English departments in the 1980s. And if there was one solid premise that everyone through all the sects, whether they be Freudians or feminists or Marxists or Derridian deconstructionists, new historicists, Foucauldians, queer theorists, it was that there is no such thing as a natural moral law. There are no universals. There is no universal truth. There is no natural reason. And so to read this, I mean, it is so far from the humanistic world of academia. I mean, the literary humanities, certainly, that it's actually quite refreshing just to see it said. There is one, and here is how we are going to demonstrate it.
Yeah, I mean, Aquinas, you know, even before anybody, at least from my students, when I've taught an introductory course on Aquinas here at Baylor, and I'll ask my students what they know about Aquinas. Now, of course, virtually all of them come from some Christian background, most of whom are evangelicals. They will usually bring up natural moral law and arguments for God's existence. Now, some of them have never heard of Aquinas, so that's another matter altogether. But yeah, even, you know, if you read Protestant authors, at some point, if they want to deal with Catholicism, it always comes back in one way or another to these two aspects of Aquinas' thinking. And what I argue in the chapter, though, is that the way in which I think certain writers look at Aquinas on these matters, they get him wrong in I think subtle ways. So let me just talk about natural theology. So natural theology is the view that, or it's a way of looking at what we can know about God apart from scripture. So so Aquinas believes that he begins the Summa Theologica with what are known as the five ways, and he actually gives arguments elsewhere in other works. He believes that we can know certain minimal things about God from just observing nature, observing things around us, reflecting on the nature of the world. Now, some evangelical writers and other non-evangelical Protestants tend to see that as a kind of first step before a believer comes to faith. And in fact, it's a common view held by a lot of evangelical authors and theologians. But when you read Aquinas, he's not saying that. He's saying that we can know these things about God as what he calls preambles of faith, but he doesn't mean preambles of faith in the sense that you need it first in order to have faith. All he's saying is that one can have knowledge of God that is not the consequence of the faith that one assents to as a result of the grace that God gives you. So somebody can come to faith without having any arguments for God's existence, which is the case with 99.9% of the people who come to faith. And in fact, one of the things that stands out in Aquinas' account is that if he actually had believed that, he would have fallen to Pelagianism, which is the view that you can actually have faith in God apart from grace. So it turns out that Aquinas's view of the role that grace plays in a person assenting to faith is not that different from, let's say, the view that one reads among certain Protestant and evangelical authors.
In this terms, would an experience of the sublime, so you know, you're looking at a beautiful sunset over the mountains and the clouds and the light streaming, and one apprehends, you know, something about the infinite. Would that be the kind of experience that he would take as one of those preambles?
Yes. In fact, the preamble doesn't even have to be the result of an argument. It can just be something you believe as a consequence of, let's say, an immediate experience. Let's say, you know, I use the example of going to the Grand Canyon, which I use because my parents took us there when we were kids, growing up in Vegas. We weren't too far away from the Grand Canyon. I never forget. I was overwhelmed by what I was seeing. It was like I was on another planet. It didn't even seem real. And I had a sense as a kid, like of the grandeur of God's creation immediately. And it wasn't an argument. It wasn't like I thought premise A, the Grand Canyon appears to me. It has premise B, it has beauty, therefore God exists. That's not, it just was immediate. And for, so that could actually be one way in which one could acquire knowledge of God. Now, of course, Aquinas believes you can have arguments, but you need not have them in order to have faith in God or even knowledge of God.
Now, you identify two Protestant critics of natural law. You give them terms: the frustrated fellow traveler and the solo scripturist. What is the frustrated fellow traveler?
One of them is, I actually single somebody out, my colleague Alan Jacobs, in an article, very brief article that he wrote, I think, for the American Conservative. It might actually been on, he might have been on a blog that I think he used to write a blog for them, have a blog on the American Conservative website. And he mentions the fact that, you know, look, people are unconvinced by natural law arguments on contested matters concerning social issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. And I say in response to Alan, in fact, by the way, I sent this to Alan before I put it in the book. I wanted to get his feedback. And so my response to Alan is that natural law was never intended, or at least the way in which Aquinas presents it. A natural law is not a kind of lingua franca that once somebody gives you the argument, you will immediately assent to it. And Aquinas himself admits this. He says, look, there's wide diversity between cultures and societies, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One reason is that people can be moved by certain passions, and these passions can distort and disfigure our understanding of the natural law. And I use as an illustration of this Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in the Obergefell case. It's interesting. He obviously is making an argument for same-sex marriage being required by the Constitution, and it's a conclusion that a traditional natural law thinker would rightfully reject. But if you read his argument, he's appealing to the kind of historical continuity of marriage over time, and he appeals to all these goods that marriage can offer people, all of which the natural law thinker agrees with. And so my point is that even in a case here where you have somebody defending a practice that is inconsistent with the natural law, he still has to rely on, at some point, the principles of the natural law. And here I'm relying a lot on C.S. Lewis's comments in The Abolition of Man. He brings that out, that even the denier of natural law, and he calls it the Tao. He doesn't call it natural law for reasons, sort of politically savvy reasons. The natural law thinking is not popular at the time, so he uses other language. But the point is that my response to Alan is, you know, Alan, Aquinas agrees with you that natural law arguments at the end of the day are incomplete. But also you can't ultimately deny every principle of natural law. So you mentioned earlier, Mark, your colleagues in English literature that say there's no such thing as a natural law. But if you look at the way in which they conduct their lives and the way in which they think of issues in social justice, aren't they sort of presupposing that there's a kind of order to things, right? That in fact there are certain goods to which human beings are inclined. And if that's the case, so for example, if you say one of them says to you, you're reading me wrong, or you don't fully understand what deconstructionist theory is, or you're not applying it correctly, all those presuppose some sort of underlying orderliness to our cognitive powers. And Aquinas would say that's the natural law. And so I do think one reason why people like Alan make the, by the way, Alan is, believes in the natural law. He doesn't disagree with it. He just thinks that it's inadequate for our public discourse. And in some ways he may be correct, but that doesn't count against the natural law as a theory or that it's not worth believing. In fact, in many ways, what Aquinas is doing is kind of giving an account of what people already believe. And it's, he's not offering it as a kind of replacement for liberal political theory, which is the way in which some people kind of think that natural law theorists are arguing in public, that along comes writers like Dworkin and Ronald Dworkin and John Rawls, who say we must have a neutral public square in which people offer public reason. And the natural law thinker comes along and says, I've got public reason, and it's the natural law. And I don't, that's not the way Aquinas thinks of the natural law. It's not a kind of substitute for, it's not for liberal political theory. It's just a kind of way to account for why civilizations and cultures happen to engage in the practices that they do.
You couldn't be a natural lawist the way you are a deconstructionist, let's say, or it's not a substantive, you know, body of belief. Really, you can't abstract it into a set of premises. I mean, you define it, but
you ultimately have to make the arguments. You know, so the example that I use, not in this chapter, not that the chapter we're talking about, but in the chapter dealing with intelligent design theory, I use the example from Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion. He is highly critical of this paleontologist who had studied at Harvard named Kurt Wise. Kurt studied under Stephen Jay Gould and left Harvard as a young earth creationist as he entered. He grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home. And Dawkins is upset about this. He says, look, this is why I really hate religion, is that it takes somebody as brilliant as Kurt Wise and destroys his career. And, you know, it's interesting, though, that Dawkins, who denies that there's any sort of underlying intrinsic purpose to nature, treats Kurt Wise in a way that condemns him for not treating his natural gifts in a way consistent with their ends, right? So that's another illustration that the example I use in class with my students, it's being aware of natural law is almost like when you try to put a bunch of stuff in a suitcase and something, and you can never quite get it all in. It keeps on popping out of the sides. So you can't fully suppress the natural law. It's going to come out in some way or another. And it could come out in a distorted way, but it's going to come out because that's just the way we're made.
What about the sola scripturist?
Yeah, the sola scripturist says that by saying that natural law is a way that we can know the moral law, you're sort of denying, you know, the role that scripture ought to play in the life of the Christian believer, right? Here I cite actually from an article that was published in First Things in 1995 by Carl Henry, and in that piece, he says that, in fact, I'll quote here from what Henry wrote. He says, the three contentions of the Thomist doctrine of natural law that evoke evangelical criticism are independently of divine revelation, there exists a universally shared body or system of moral beliefs that human reasoning articulates despite the noetic consequences of the Adamic fall. And what Henry is saying is that Aquinas's view of natural law, you know, really doesn't take into consideration the fact that human beings are suffer from total depravity, and that our cognitive powers really aren't that good when it comes to knowing morality. And what I do in that section of the chapter is I point out that Aquinas himself actually doesn't disagree. He thinks that there are all sorts of reasons why human beings can get the moral law wrong, and for that reason, we need scripture. In fact, the natural law gives us such minimal information It doesn't give us anything, doesn't tell us anything about our ultimate salvation. It doesn't tell us anything about the particulars of the natural law. So the example I use in the book is, you know, maybe the natural law can tell us that marriage is a natural good, but it can't tell us it's a sacrament or that it's ordained by God. That's something that we can only know through special revelation. So yeah, the sola scripturist, you know, sees natural law as a kind of something in competition with scripture. But in reality, Aquinas himself says that it's not in competition at all. It's a sort of preamble to faith, and just like those arguments for natural theology. But it's something that we can that we can know. But it's not as detailed as people. The claims of natural law are not as detailed or as sure that as people like Henry think that the Thomist is claiming. So, in fact, what I do in that chapter is I go over several different places in Scripture where it seems as though the natural law is presupposed. So for example, Jesus, while preaching, says that a good father would not give his child a scorpion and claim that it's a loaf of bread, right? Why does that work? Well, it's because Jesus knows that his audience knows what good fathers are supposed to do. Right. So there's even built into some of the lessons that we learn in Scripture are kind of natural law assumptions.
You talk about a controversy that you stumbled into when you first went to Baylor, and it's on page 60 in here when you arrived and quite willingly, collegially, you went to give some testimony on intellectual design. What happened there? And how does Aquinas come in to reflect upon the whole issue?
Yeah, 2 years before I came to Baylor, I spent a year at Washington University in St. Louis, where I earned a graduate degree in law, Master of Juridical Studies, and I wrote a dissertation as part of that degree, and it was on the question of whether you can teach intelligent design in public schools without violating the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. And I came to the conclusion that, in fact, you can. Now, it turns out there was a federal district court judge in Pennsylvania who disagrees with me, who thinks that that, in fact, it is unconstitutional. I still stand by that view, that I still think there's nothing unconstitutional about a public school offering it.
Frank, what are judges weighing in on these theological curricular issues for?
Yeah, it's because, well, there's a long history that goes all the way back to the Scopes trial. And so I weighed in on it, and then I arrived at Baylor in 2003, and the week that I arrived in Waco, I was asked by a member of the Board of Education, the Texas Board of Education, to testify at a hearing for textbook acquisitions. Texas is in California, the two biggest states when it comes to textbook sales. And so there was a lot of political lobbying to change the textbooks to include criticisms of Darwinism. And so somebody on the board came across a portion of my dissertation, which I had published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and invited me to testify for 3 minutes on why I thought it would be permissible to include some criticisms of Darwinism in the textbooks. And when I arrived, I walked into this room. There were hundreds of people there, cameras, television cameras, and national media. I had no idea how big this was. And when I drove back to Waco, a couple of weeks later, I received a letter in the mail from
and you simply were laying out in simply, yeah, there's room for some criticisms of evolution on these grounds here and that. That was it.
And I got a letter in the mail from an alumnus of Baylor, a descendant of the academic unit in which I held my the namesake of the academic unit in which I held my appointment. And she and 27 of her relatives asked the president of Baylor to remove me because my views were not consistent with those held by her ancestor, and who was the founder of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. So it was a tough time for me emotionally. I'd never been put in the public eye in that way. I was on the front page of the Waco Trib. and then the Chronicle of Education did a big story on it. All these bloggers got involved. And I was, accused of being a creationist, which I'm not. I never have been. Creationism being a kind of a view that the earth is very young and that we should interpret the first several chapters of Genesis in a literal fashion. It's a view I never even held as an evangelical.
Frank, it's what happens when ideas get thrown into a political context.
Yeah. So I at the time I was kind of sympathetic to the intelligent design view, although I had not really cared that much about the arguments. I really cared more about the legal question. Because for me, it was almost a paradigm case of religious citizens offering arguments consistent with public reason that happened to have a conclusion favorable to religion. So I thought this is a really interesting case, the ID case, right? So all the kind of liberal thinking out there says if you're a religious citizen, you enter the public square, you need public reasons that don't depend on your scripture. And I thought, well, here, these ID guys are doing that, right? They're offering kind of public reasons. I thought this is interesting. It is consistent with my own sort of project in political and social philosophy. So I pursued it. But I got to admit, I was sympathetic though to the view, but I just had not really spent much time thinking about it in terms of whether the arguments were good or bad for ID. I was just interested in the sort of political legal question. Well, as the years passed after that, I began reading thinkers critical of intelligent design who were largely Thomists. And I began to see, I came to the conclusion that there were flaws in the way in which ID advocates approached the relationship between divine action and creation. So let me give you an example of what I mean. One of the leading ID theorists, a friend of mine, Bill Dembski, offers this, what he calls an explanatory filter. What he means by that is there's a way to exclude when we see things in the world, exclude chance and law. So let's say I toss in the air a bunch of Scrabble letters, and they all are Scrabble tiles, and they fall randomly. However they land can be just attributed to chance and law. It just just throw them up in the air, and you don't think that it's the result of sort of putting the letters together to spell a sentence like go to Baltimore or something like that, right? But supposing though I did throw them up, and they landed in a way that spelled an intelligible sentence like Nebuchadnezzar is my next door neighbor or something like that, and you go wow, and what Dembski says is, well, you have to infer from that there's some kind of intelligent agent behind it, even though it may seem that it's random. I mean, you just tossed the tiles up. You had to believe that somebody intervened in some way, right? Maybe some invisible agent and why do we believe that? Well, we exclude chance and law, and we look at the detachability of it. That is, can we envision it in our minds prior to it landing in a particular way or observing it. But what occurred to me, and after reading a lot of the Thomist critics of ID, is that as a theist, though, I don't believe that God simply is the creator of those things that happen to exhibit design or order in terms of this explanatory filter. I also think that God created the chance and the law too. So it seemed to me then that the ID advocates were fighting with people like Richard Dawkins over a narrow sliver of nature. So to use an example from Michael Behe's work, another ID advocate. So the bacterial flagellum seems to exhibit all the characteristics of an outboard motor. So that seems we should believe that there is an intelligent designer to that. But there are other as a theist, we just don't believe that God created just that. we also believe he created those things that appear to be random, those things that appear to be just scientific laws. And so I kind of drifted away from ID because I think it has a diminished understanding of divine action. But what I found in Aquinas is that for Thomas, God is not just the creator of those things that science can't explain, but God is the creator of those things, everything. Even so he not only made the bacterial flagellum, he also made those things that seem to not require direct intervention in any way. Right. So in other words, we don't need space in nature for God to act. And that was a real about, I'd say about maybe 12 years ago or so, maybe 13. It was a real turning point in my, and I thought, and the reason it was tough for me to move away from that is that I saw ID as a response to the influence of naturalism and secularism on the academy. And so it took but the Thomas scholars convinced me that this was not a good way to respond to naturalism, that it was actually giving away too much real estate to the adversaries of theism. And so I write the chapter as somebody who is friendly to intelligent design. I mean, I have many friends who are defenders of it, people that I respect, people who I think are a lot smarter than me who defend it. But I just think that it's a mistake strategically to argue that way.
Very good. Give us the title of the book again, full title.
Okay, Never Doubt Thomas, The Catholic Aquinas as Evangelical and Protestant.
Very good, with Baylor University Press. And we'll have to have you back, Frank, to continue the discussion.
Great.